seen anything like that.
I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it!
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
And you're very welcome to the first Golf Weekly of 2026. I do hope that you had a very nice Christmas and a Happy New Year beckons. This week, we're going to kick off by unpacking Brooks Koepka's exit from LIV, which was announced just before Christmas. So what does it say about his peak years, his relationship with the biggest stages, and is there still time for him to get back to where we all feel he belongs? Tiger Woods turned 50 on the 31st of December, and it seems that inevitability has given way to uncertainty. We're going to reflect on what that milestone means. And also as well, is there some interesting comparisons between the greats, including him, obviously, before and after. Like, I mean, does anybody really believe that there's one final chapter left in maybe the most garlanded story in golf? We're also going to pay tribute to Jumbo Ozaki, who died just before Christmas, a Japanese golf legend who, well, he shaped golf very much on his own terms. And as always, very happy to welcome Gary Murphy. Gary, how are you?
I'm good, Sean. I have a little bit of the lurgy, but
you and many, many others. Well, a happy new year to you, my friend. And joining us for the first time, a very special guest, Shane O'Grady, one of the most influential coaches in Irish golf, who's been trusted with a number of elite players, not least Leona Maguire, and is also quietly guiding the next wave of hopeful Irish superstars, including Max Kennedy. You're very welcome, Shane.
Thank you very much, Phil.
Good to have you. So, lots to get through, lots to argue about, hopefully, and, well, plenty to enjoy. Okay, this is Golf Weekly. Let's get into it. Shane, now, you're best known for coaching Leona, so I guess is, how is Leona?
She's great, yeah. Yeah? Just went back to the States over the weekend, had her Christmas break, and back into pre-season work, so.
I mean, at a distance, it's fair to say that Leona's 2025 probably wasn't as stellar as many of us expected it to be, or maybe even Leona herself expected it to be.
Yeah, from the outside looking in, that may be the case, but very small margins between, I think she finished 58th, 59th on the LPGA money list, so very small margins between that and, say, top 20.
I mean,
putting start here and, you know, a few greens more in regulation throughout the year, it's very small margins between the two.
I mean, she's, not to just reduce it down to dollar terms, but, you know, she's doing okay.
Yeah. No, it's good. And golf on tour is, it's very much like a heartbeat. It's up and down. You go through some really good years and then drops off a bit and you come again. I think all players, you know, see that happen. So, yeah, she's going to be coming again.
And is there anything that she caused her to reflect on, I mean, 59th, look, obviously 59th is great. She's held her tour card. She's very much middle of the pack. But we, you know, we want her to be top 10 all the time. And if she's not making top 10s, inevitably we're going like, what the hell is going on with Leona Maguire? Is there anything that she worked on in the off season to prep her for 2026?
It's a very quick turnaround from their end of season is November. So, more gym work and more of the same. And first tournament goes out in the Far East by, I think, in first week in March. So she'll do at Lake Nona, where she's a member there in Orlando. She's back. She'll be playing with a lot of her friends there. A lot of their fellow pros are members there. So she'll practice some hard money games with them and get going again.
How, I mean, I'm going to assume well, but how well has she settled into life on the LPGA Tour?
Well, she loves it, yeah.
Does she?
She loves it, yeah. Yeah.
Like, what does, like, you know, describe, like, I mean, I'm just trying to get a sense of a typical week in the life of an LPGA star.
Well, it's no different than the PGA Tour, and it's brilliant this year going forward. We'll see a lot more of it on mainstream TV because for the first time it's going to be live on the Golf Channel in America, so Sky then possibly will pick on that. I don't have that for a fact, but I would imagine they will pick onto that. So we'll see a lot more of it. A lot of the time we only see the highlights of it late in the evening or the majors. So people will get a lot more of a feel of the heartbeat of what goes on on the LPGA Tour rather than just sort of what they pick up from the majors or the televised thing they see on a Monday evening or something like that. So it's no different than the PGA Tour. It's a big production. You know, every week it's superstars, super players. It's a super league of ladies golf, and that's why it's so sought after to get on it. The best 100 players, lady players in the world, are Koreans, Chinese, Australians, a mix of everyone there.
Does she have pals on tour?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Is there, is there anyone she's particularly close to or hangs out with?
Well, there's about six or seven LPGA players that are members in Lake Nona, so they all hang out and play together off and at tournaments and stuff like that. Yeah. So she's good friends with Lydia Ko, Lindy Duncan, to name a few. So,
yeah. Gary, inevitably, and I hold myself to account here, but it must be very frustrating for players in the heart of the action that if you, like, as Leona finished 59th, for people to kind of despair and go, oh, something's seriously wrong with her, when, as Shane says, it's just a question of, like, super fine margins, a put here, yeah, put there, and, like, yeah. Gary, what do you think?
Yeah, well, 59th was my best finish on tour, so I think she had a great year last year.
How are you, Gary?
Hi, Shane, how are you? Nice to have you here too. Yeah, it is. It's people, it's like, you know, it's the great factor with the Irish public. You know, you want to kind of wrap yourself around someone and they're going to win majors and do all of this. Like, we're so astonishingly blessed to have someone like Rory McIlroy in the men's game. He's a complete outlier. He's not. He's a generational talent. He just happens to be from Ireland. But, you know, the reality is, if Leona finished 59th for the next 10 years, she'd have the most amazing career. So, you know, even being out there and being above standard on the LPGA Tour is a phenomenal achievement. It's just, it's a hard sell to go, oh, she finished 59th. But the reality is she's one of the, you know, the finest women's players in the world. You're just going to see how good she is when you're going to see all these younger players coming through and how difficult it is for them to achieve what she's already achieved so far. And hopefully there's, you know, there's a lot more to come. I think this year is a really important year for her because she's kind of fallen a tiny bit outside the superstars of the sport. So I think, and it's, Leona's no different to any player. Everyone's looking for a good start to try convince yourself again that you're good enough and it's all there. And, you know, I think the off season at times gets a bit overplayed. 90% of the time it's really for rest and recovery, unless you've had a major pressing issue with your game throughout the season. But I'd say Leona was just glad to get home and get a bit of turkey and ham and a bit of stuff and then a bit of normality, you know, because whilst, and this is from the outside looking in, but, you know, whilst Leona's living in Florida and that's, you know, her base and all that, you know, there's nothing like coming home at Christmas and just seeing old friends and, you know, even like, and this is a little bit off piece, but I was at Paul McGinley's dad's funeral the other day.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Mick passed away.
Yeah, and, you know, condolences to all the McGinleys. And, you know, Mick was a great man, but it was just great to see so many old faces. You know, there was, you know, people that I would have played Southeastern Alliances with when I was a kid coming up and looking up to them because they were senior cup players. And, you know, so it's nice to get home from the kind of Ferris wheel of pro golf and a bit of normality. Hopefully she can get off to a flyer at the start of this season.
Yeah.
Shane, I mean, it's well noted for a long time that Leona's relative lack of length off the tee, I mean, weirdly makes her, like, certainly one of the best hybrid player I've ever seen. Like, she's unbelievable with those hybrids. But, like, how does she mitigate that relative lack of distance compared to, say, the absolute, you know, the Korda, the Nelly Kordas of this world?
Well, it's a different game. Unless, well, it's very few Nelly Kordas. Nelly Korda, you know, you see her playing with the men, she hits it quite far.
Yeah.
But most of the LPGA courses are somewhere between 6,700 yards to 7,000 yards for some of the majors now, which is incredible. To think back when I dabbled a little bit in pro golf back in the early 90s, that if you had a 7,000 yard golf course, it would seem to be a monster, do you know?
Yeah.
And now the ladies are playing courses that we would see to be as monster when they play a major. But Leona isn't as short as people think.
No, you know, I appreciate that.
But compared to Anelli, I get it. But it's a different, Leona's always played her game and engineered her way around the golf course. And that's all she can do is look after her bit. and she focuses on her wedge play, where some of them might be able to hit a par 5 and 2. She'll engineering it in a different way.
But and she's never succumbed to the disease, and I use air quotes, that so many golfers have of chasing length.
Yeah, always working out. She's always working in the gym. She's good at that. But the, you know, the incremental gain of hitting it out to being an Nelly Korda, you're never going to do that.
No.
You're not. You know.
No, but and that's fair enough. Like, you don't have to be striping a 310 off the
tee.
No,
but you're always trying to get a little gain here and there. Yeah, no, it's like when I'm saying small little, the difference even in the putting. Putting is incredible throughout the year. There's so much stats nowadays. It's incredible to look at it. But putting stats this year, I think her average putts are 29. She led the putting stats 2 years ago at low 28s. So even that in itself, over a period of a year, is incredible. Mm, and just reflecting it to even Lauren Walsh there a few weeks back in Alabama, to get to Alabama, everything fell her way in Marbella the week before, where she finished 10th. And she finished 10th by 2 points on their order of merit. And she equated that back, Lauren is pretty good at the maths, equated that back to one shot throughout the entire year. That's the difference between her finishing 10th and 11th and getting to the LPGA Tour. She said it was one shot it equated to. Such small margins between what you're talking about. So all you're doing is keep looking after your own little corner. You're trying to improve your own little things and keep getting better.
Gary,
Shane, where are the challenges for you then as a coach to these players when, you know, sometimes you can see stuff that they don't, because obviously that's your job, and trying to get that information across without upsetting the apple cart.
Yeah, good question, Gary. Yeah, no, sometimes you, and I think I've got better at it through the years, is holding back information sometimes. You know, you go to a tournament, you're there, you prep, you're trying to get them going as good as you can. Generally before the majors, I go to a lot of the majors. So you're getting them going, and you might see something on the course, and even though they're playing well, sometimes you've got to hold it back in reserve for the week off. And that's a skill in itself to not to dive in and maybe fix something that needs to be fixed, and then they miss the cut. So, you have to be discreet and know the right time to try and deep dive and improve something. I think that's very intuitiveness. I don't think there's a script for doing that.
You have, certainly in terms of relationships with players, longevity. Like, there's players you've been coaching for a long, long time, and not just Leona. You've been coaching Max Kennedy since he was a kid.
Yeah.
Like, what, in your view, is good long-term development? Like, if you zoom out, what does that look like to you?
When I get a kid that is into it and they have all the attributes that they want, very important, and I listened to one of Gary's podcast there last year, and I think it's very important that it has to come from the kid. And when they want it and their desire is to be a good player,
you're wise.
But that is not the parents.
It's true, though.
But it's not the parents' want. It's not the parents' dream. It's the kids' dream. You know, and they want to be a good player. Then they'll surround them with the right information and build a sort of a tree of where they need to be. It's like a pyramid of the amateur games, because they have to succeed in the amateur game first before they're going to have any chance of doing it in the pro game. And build a structure around their short game. They're not going to be able to play at top level unless they're pitching all different grasses. Their technique has to be good. Their putting has to be good. And just try to keep building it each stage, each year, and assess it every year. And some of them keep growing up that pyramid. Lauren refers to that a lot when she got up to the top of her pyramid and what's next. And we build a new pyramid. And some kids only go so far up the pyramid, and that's good too. Yeah. You know, playing for Ireland or whatever level they achieve, isn't it? It's fantastic.
How do you stop the juniors from rushing the process? Because, you know, like any young person, you're impatient. You see the target, you want to get there quicker.
Yeah, and that's even harder nowadays with social media and everything. Yeah. Definitely see it. Rather than, you know, they're going to play bad. They're going to have to accept playing bad. And that's part of the journey of becoming a better player, learning how to play bad better. That's what I tell my players. When you're playing bad, to be able to still shoot 70. That's a skill better than being able to shoot 64. Because a good player can shoot 64. They wouldn't be going out on tour unless they can shoot 64. But if they can turn the bad day and the bad week into making a cut and finishing 6-7 under par, that's a real skill. And I'm sure you had that skill, Gary, when you were doing it. Not necessarily having your A game, but getting through the week. And that's a sort of an untalked about skill. And I think that's relying on your short game.
I think as well, like there's a big move away now in the championships in Ireland. We're just chat about the amateur scene for a sec, that, you know, we played, you know, west of Ireland, south of Ireland, north of Ireland, and more often than not in bad weather. And Pádraig Harrington was the best bad golfer that ever played amateur golf. Like I would have played Pádraig in too many matches, but he'd be playing really poorly and he just kept scoring.
Break your heart.
I think he broke a lot of people's hearts, didn't he?
Yeah, I remember playing regularly, break my heart with the putter. Yeah,
but I think a lot of that graft in bad weather where, you know, 3 and 4 over par, you know, is a great score. You know, and you're playing in the West and you're 3 over 3-7 or something, trying to break 77 or 78, that teaches you a lot about, you know, a lot of things that you need to know. And then playing a lot of match play golf, which they seem to be trying to take away from, you know, I know times change and everything moves, you know, a little bit forward, not always the case, but all the championships that we had have produced the Darren Clarks and the Paul McGinleys and Pádraig Harringtons, Rory McIlroys and Shane Lowrys, you know, and Paul Dunn came through and, you know, was a new star coming out on tour and was unlucky with injuries. And that's where life gets in the way too. But I think all those championships creates a little bit of inner steel. And the thing with the pro game as well, there's only a tiny percentage you're ever going to get through and be successful anyway.
Yeah.
And it's very challenging for coaches to try taper down expectations of young kids.
And that's how do you, I mean, I'm sure you've coached many a talented youngster, male and female, and then at some point you realize, you know what, for whatever reason, they're not going to make it in the pro game.
So I'm honest with any of the players I work with, and to be honest with themselves, that they're not, you know, delusional about it. And if you have proper goal setting at the beginning of every year, you set a goal. It might be to win a boys' championship, it might be to win a girls' championship, it might be to win the Irish Ladies' Close, or whatever it may be. And you set about and you go get stuck into what have you to do to achieve that. And then you assess it and it's all short-term goals for the end, long-term goal. And that sort of caps it a little bit. It stops people running away. And the goal is, in the modern game, I don't see too many other people being able to do this, but I think the modern game is so, the standard is so high and the level, you have to go and play college golf for 4 years to know how good you are. If you don't test yourself a bit against that the other best players in the world who are all in the States playing, it's professional amateur golf. And you'll know after 4 years, if you're not doing it and cutting it in the world rankings nowadays, you're delusional. If you know, if you're not in the top 500 or 1,000, there's no point in saying you're going to be, you know, making the money on a main tour or even getting, you wouldn't get past the second tour if you're not doing that.
Shane, what's the challenge for you when you say someone like Max, you've worked with Max a long time. And he's gone through the American system, maintaining that relationship. Because I fell out with a guy a couple of years ago. There was a young kid who is not from Ireland, but he had an opportunity to go to college in America. And he was a really talented player. He was a super kid. His folks didn't have the means. And he got a scholarship. But the coach had no interest in him going because, I'm going to lose him to this college system in America. And my point was, don't care about you. It's about the child's, what's best for the kid. But you seem to be able to let them off and hang on to them. What's the secret to that?
Well, I'd be very much hands-on with guiding them to go there in the first place. I've had huge success in the States. I have 5-6 players there at the moment, in the men's, and not in the ladies at the moment, one going. But I would guide them and guide them to go to the correct college. There's so many colleges. The right fit for them, whether it's, you know, with their academics, some of them are very academic. So to keep their academics, that they're not wasting 4 years of their life, that if golf doesn't work out, they haven't wasted their academic ability. Some of them with less academic ability, and to try and reach out to the coach that's there. A lot of the coaches in America, they're not golf coaches; they're facilitators.
Yeah. Explain that.
They're not golf coaches. A lot of them. Yeah. They're facilitators. They're brilliant at what they do, and you've been there, Gary. So You understand this, the assistant coach, the coach, they get the team together for practice every week. They set up drills. They bring them to the tournaments. They bring them on the bus. They do all of that stuff. It's like if they moved over to being a hockey coach to do the same.
Oh, really?
So there are, a lot of them aren't golf professionals or proficient in it, but they dabble in it if you let them. So a lot of my players, when they're going there, they know exactly, and the coach knows I'm going to continually coach them. I would do visits. I might go to the States and see them in downtime. I've done that with Leona and Lisa a lot when they were in Duke. Lauren, when she was Wake Forest. I've had Gavin Moynan, who years ago went over to Alabama. Came home, didn't work out for him.
Max Kennedy went to the University of Louisville.
Max every 2 weeks would do a Zoom, a video on WhatsApp from his indoor facility in Louisville, and we'd just check over fundamentals. And Anthony's doing, we'd share it every 2 weeks or so. And then he's home at Christmas and home during the summer, and we continue that sort of relationship. So it doesn't allow the extra noise or the extra voices getting in there trying to change techniques. And I remember Casey Martin, who's in Oregon, had a player go to Casey Martin over in Oregon. Great, they had just won the Nationals, I think, the previous year. And Casey, I remember saying to me, he was very honest. He played on tour. He was the guy who got dispensation to use the buggy for the first time. I think he was in college in Stanford with Tiger.
That's right.
He was a great guy and loved his golf. But he said, don't send me over somebody who's going to think they're going to a golf academy. They're coming here to play golf. I want them to be able to play golf when they come here. They're not coming here to get better. Technically, you're coming here to get the experience of playing golf, which will make you better golfer, but not technically. You're not coming here to learn a swing. And a lot of people have this perception. They get to a certain stage at 18 in Ireland and they go, I'll go next 4 years, I'm going to get better with my technical. You have to have your technique in place and your team around you when you're going there, or you're going to fall flat because you're going to get all the outside noise, and that's when you're just going to confuse you even more.
That's fascinating. So is that the norm with golf systems or whatever, golf programs at all the different universities?
You can be lucky and have somebody who's really, really good, but even the guy that's really, really good, or the lady who's really, really good, you know, Dan Brooks was fantastic in Duke, Dan, great knowledge of it, but he wouldn't overstep that. You know, if he saw something on course, like what Gary asked me earlier on, he'd be discreet, he'd bounce it off me, what do you think, if this, he wouldn't just jump in. And Kim in Wake Forest, fantastic pedigree in America. She was in Virginia before that, won numerous NCAAs. Brilliant. When Lauren went there, she saw something at a tournament, she wouldn't just jump in. She'd be on the phone to me going, will we improve her this way? Or what do you think? Or have you seen this before? And that's the holistic team approach. But that's very seldom you see that.
But then that means that you're developing the relationships with the coaches at the various golf programs off your own steam.
Yeah.
And then, say, for example, for Leona and Lisa, when they went to Duke, I'm assuming that that conversation would be had at the outset. And Leona would know, you know, Shane's my coach.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's just...
I think everyone has a different formula.
Sure.
It's not my formula. The formula that works for me is that I keep my eye on it, because obviously I've built up a relationship with a kid and I really want to see them do well. So you're sort of just mentoring them and guide them along the way. And then when they finish in college, you know, they either go into the pro ranks like some of them do, or else they go into the real world and come home and play some amateur golf and get a job. But I think it's so important to guide them in that way, that they're not going in blindfolded. A lot of kids I see from afar go there thinking, and parents go there thinking they're going to get better. The American kids, the really good American kids or Asian kids, whoever, to go there, they do the same. They have their infrastructure around them. They have a coach off-site that they can go off and see. They have their own fitness coaches. They have all of that sort of there.
So effectively, I mean, I'm just trying to think. I imagine that, let's say, for example, a football program at a big, you know, Big Ten school in America is that when they bring in kids from high school, they assume that quarterback knows how to throw the ball. He knows how to play. What you're going to learn here is our book. You're going to learn our playbook.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to teach you the fundamentals of how to throw a football.
You've got to be able to play when you go there.
And it's similar.
Yeah, you haven't got that scholarship for...
I never would have thought. I would have just assumed that, like, exactly what you described, that as an 18-year-old that I win a scholarship to go play golf at Duke or Alabama or Stanford or wherever, and that all of a sudden I'm going to be passed into the hands of that golf coach who is going to just improve my game. But no. My game improves simply through the act of playing competitively at a very high level.
But there's a few things, Fionn. There's a load of different, more so than other sports, and I think you'll agree with this, Gary, when people hear about coaching in golf, technical coaching and development as a player, it can be two different things totally.
Yeah.
Performance coaching is very different. It's labelled differently nowadays. The technical side has to be proficient. You have to be able to play the game at a high level before going there in the first place. You wouldn't get these scholarships. Then you have to maintain that as the body is growing and developing and getting stronger and overseeing that all of a sudden, if you're a stone heavier on muscle after 4 years of gym program in America, and to know that that's the right gym program you're doing. I've had kids go there and they're doing the wrong gym program, and you've had to step in and say, no, that's wrong, because it'll lead to injury, because it's different than the gym program we would have had here. You know, and we use some great strength and condition coaches in Ireland. And then I think some very good coaching, even though it's not technical coaching, they learn from a mentoring. It's more mentoring on how to play the game, the stats information back from the team. They're learning that stuff, which is different. It's a different label than what I'm talking about, the technical, being able to swing the club good, having ownership of your own swing and understanding it, not going there trying to find it.
Yeah,
you shouldn't be going there trying to find it. If you're going there trying to find it, you're going to get lost.
I go looking for my swing every Saturday at Killeen Castle. Are you kidding me? I wanted to ask you just quickly, we've mentioned Max Kennedy a couple of times, but went to the University of Louisville.
Yep.
Turned pro just over a year ago.
Yep.
Challenge tour status. He just missed out on a full tour card as an amateur. Like already straight away, you're like, ooh, how interesting.
But he was 25th in the world amateur rankings.
Yeah, so this is a guy with oodles and oodles of talent. But as a guy that you've been coaching since he was 10, like what the thing that marks him out other than just like ability to play golf at a very high level? What is it?
Hard work.
Yes.
And anyone that knows Max and played with him sees his development. Overachieved. He's worked so hard. He just keeps getting better and better. And his graph, and like we talked about earlier, some people are very good and then they level off. Some people just incrementally get better each year. And Max keeps getting better.
Yeah.
Keeps getting better. But his willpower and his want to achieve has always been incredible.
And he's not accelerating the process. He's sticking.
Yep.
He's got the short-term goals that then lead to the long-term goals.
Yep. And he also was that first year of this player pathway that comes from college system in America, where I think it's the top two now. It was top one. It's called the UL from the university. You get your tour card if you're the number one ranked player coming out of college. So the down from that, the next five, I think, get Corn Ferry. And in Max's year, it was the first year for the European Tour to give out Challenge Tour status from that. They didn't give a tour card. I think they gave the tour card this year to a guy. I'm not sure, Gary.
Cameron Adam got it this year.
Yeah. And the way that works is that the guys that are finished in college that are next ranked on the world rankings. So Max actually he was 25th in the world rankings at the time, and he actually had status on the Challenge Tour, even if he didn't get it at tour school. So he had achieved that from his amateur game, which is quite an achievement.
I think it's one of the great things to come out of LIV, because LIV we're looking at...
He performed quite well in the LIV events that he played in. Yeah.
Yeah, but if you look at what LIV did, and I think he's going to be an absolute superstar, that Spanish kid Ballester.
Yes.
But they poached him through the amateur system because the PGA Tour had started this thing. And it makes sense, really, to try hang on to your talent. You know, if you can get... Because with a lot of these amateur kids, and even with Shane, if you think of Shane, when Shane won the Irish Open and he came out on tour, he struggled enormously, like his first couple of months. He was just a rabbit in the headlights. But he had...
Poor Shane.
He had time. Now, he's since gone on to do pretty okay.
He's a lad.
It takes a while sometimes to find your way.
But he had that winning category where he had time. So given these kids that have, you know, elite level performance, time to have a full season and find your feet is enormous. So I think his progression is really good. I think he had a fantastic year last year on Challenge Tour. Very unlucky not to get a full status, and this is a huge year for him, because as Shane was saying, like he has to keep on improving. And sometimes the second year can be a little bit tougher because there's a novelty that's kind of not there anymore, but there's still, there's probably more expectations. So trying to deal with that is going to be a big thing for him this year. But he's, it's great to see a new name coming through.
At the Hotel Planner event in Killeen Castle, which is taking place this year again, I was speaking to one of the directors at Hotel Planner, and I asked him straight out, is this like, what in your view is the single biggest challenge that all these players face in terms of like going above, keep progressing? Because I'm looking at them, they all have amazing games. You watch them on the range, they're all like hitting it a bomb, you know. And he without hesitation, he just went, is adjusting to life on tour. It's the hardest thing. People underestimate how difficult it is being away from home, having the grind of it. Is that something, I mean, obviously you must have observed that.
Yes, definitely. And I've seen it with Lauren on the LET. The last 2 years were fantastic, having the couple of girls there that she knew. So it became like a bond out there. They were having dinner together in the evenings and stuff like that. So that was fantastic. It is a big adjustment, and it's a big business.
We're talking about young people after all. And like, if you're a teenager or just barely into your 20s, like friendships are everything. Like you're, the architecture on which you build your self-esteem, on which you build your sense of self in relation to the world. You need friends. You need a support network around you. And as a golfer, by definition, you spend a huge amount of time on your own.
Yeah.
It's got to be horrendous.
I wouldn't say so. As a golfer, I think at a young age, if this is your game, you spend time on your own. I know myself, I had no problem spending time on my own. I loved what I did, hitting balls.
You're all weirdos. You're all weirdos.
No, we're not.
I'm kidding.
Yeah, no. But no, but it's not strange to the person who's doing it.
Yeah, no, no.
Because they know no different. Would you? I wouldn't.
Totally.
You're in your own bubble. You're on your own mission of where you want to go. So it's strange for the outside looking in, but not for the person doing it. They're loving every bit of it. They're loving every bit of it on that journey.
An example, Fionn, I've been off sick and I had surgery and whatnot. So I've been home more than I would normally be. And I literally cannot wait to go away and be at a turn to my own. So, you know, and just do your thing.
It's in your blood.
You have
I get that. Listen, I've talked to Damien Delaney, for instance, about his career as a footballer. And he echoes a lot of what you're saying, is that like in order to succeed, it's about having that single-minded focus on your goals. And yes, you're part of a team, and yes, you belong to this bigger network, but ultimately is that you're the one who delivers in training. You're the one who shows up. You're the one who has to do things, you know? And if you're not doing it, you will soon be forgotten and left behind.
Yeah, but yeah, if you figure out, I think there's a huge part of being successful keeps coming back to what I said earlier on, having your B game, and that comes back to your short game. I think one of the biggest adjustments for a lot of people coming out of college is the time, the scheduling. When they're in college, you go play a tournament, maybe two on the spin, then you come back and you qualify again. You have 2 or 3 weeks of intensive practice getting ready for the next tournament. You've prepped the course. You've done all the stats. On tour, you go out, all of a sudden, you've got your card, you go 3-4 weeks in a row trying to find what works for you. You arrive at the venue on a Sunday night or a Monday morning. You might play 9 holes when you get there. You've never been at this place before. You do some wedge play or something that afternoon. Go to bed. The next morning, you play the back nine. The pro-am, if you're new on the tour, you're probably not in the pro-am. So you're only going to get 18 holes. You're only playing the front nine, the back nine. You have limited practice, and next thing you're ready to go on Thursday. And that's different than what you're used to. And it's how to manage that time that your game is still very sharp.
Yeah.
A lot of people, it's the small gains that we talked about earlier on. It's that when you miss a green, that your pitching and your bunker play is so sharp. It's a lot of people look at the birdie count. It's actually the less shots you drop will shape how good you are in the first few years. So if you're making 5 birdies, if you're making a lot of bogeys, you have to make more and more birdies.
Yeah.
Less bogeys, and that comes down to your short game, and that's prepping when you get to the tournament to be at the same standard as you were when you were elite amateur. Mm. That's sort of my take on it.
Shane, what's the future looking like for Lauren Walsh this season?
She'll start out in the first 2 events she doesn't get into because it's a top 60 in the field, no cut. So she'll start in China towards the end of March. So she'll play in Saudi on the LET in the end of February, a week off, and then go straight in. And then go from there back over to the stateside for 3 in a run and go from there. She's got the British Open. She's exempt in the British Open. And the other majors, there's five majors on the ladies' circuit compared to the men's. And it's just all about her ranking from there. So just she's excited to get going. And
Lads, I want to move it along slightly. You would have all seen the news just before Christmas that Brooks Koepka announced he was leaving LIV. He was breaking his contract a little early. He signed 2022, so yeah, not even 3.5 years, just over 3.5 years. He talked about more time at home. Now, it is worth pointing out that Brooks and his family, they suffered a loss last year. His wife had a miscarriage that clearly impacted them, and perhaps the two are connected. But I guess the first question I have, Gary, do you think this is a blow to LIV?
Well, it's undoubtedly a blow to LIV. I think outside of Rory McIlroy, you know, and the hype around the Shambo, Brooks Koepka, five-time major champion, is the one of the kind of pillars of the sport, really. Up to his departure, or on his departure to LIV, he kind of thought this was a bit of a paycheck. But then he won the PGA and he almost won a Masters, so he was still the kind of alpha male on tour. But he's always had this thing where, you know, and I guess it's a sign of greatness that he can switch off and look disinterested and then be able to switch on and win five major championships. So the LIV Tour was a money grab more than anything. At the time, he was worried about an injury to his knee, and he's getting a check for $100 million allegedly. So he was kind of securing his future. We spoke to him last year at the Irish Open.
We did.
He seemed very keen to want to play. We were excited that he was playing an Irish Open. And then he went on to play another three or four events. I don't buy that. By the family time and all that stuff at home, I think that's a load of horseshit, really.
Well, he, Shane,
it's the narrative of, you know, he's in the prime of his golfing career. I don't think he's excited to be a LIV player anymore.
So, Shane, he announced his departure from, he took the LIV, he didn't say it was about the money, he said it was about having a lighter schedule so he could spend more time at home. Fine. And to Gary's point, I wouldn't disagree with him. I think the more family time, in spite of the very clear difficulties his family suffered in the last year, I suspect with Brooks, having spoken to him for all of 8 minutes at the Irish Open last year, he's always struck me as a person whose ultimate loyalties are to himself and his own family, that the PGA Tour, like, remember in the early days of his career, he had a real deep resentment against the PGA Tour because, you know, he spent so much time on the European Tour that he didn't care about LIV. He didn't care about the PGA Tour. For him, ultimately, is like what suits him. And I don't mean that in any way judgmentally. I actually kind of think that, as Gary says, it's the mark of a champion.
Yeah. Yeah. And you were saying there about the quality time. What's the LIV schedule? Is it 20 events? Is it max?
14 plus you play the 14. Majors and you probably have to play a couple of Asian events. So it's probably 20 events.
20 events. And then you see the likes of what you saw get there, Gary. They go on a run of five or six events from the Irish Open onwards that are outside their schedule. And now they're nearly up to the same schedule as they were given out about. you wouldn't want to read too much into what they're saying they left for in the first place. I have a feeling that it'll come back, that they'll announce that he's back playing in Pebble Beach or something in their year, and it'll be a big PR stunt for the PGA Tour, and it'll be great. It'll create, I think it's all good. The more they're talking about different these scenarios, the more it brings attention to golf and the rivalry between why did Brooks leave, and maybe DeChambeau might come back, and they were having a right ding dong at each other before the two of them went to LIV, and that created a great interest as well. What was Brooks saying to DeChambeau, and now they seem to be great friends. So it's all good.
I'm looking here. So he's exempt through 2028 in all four majors, and he's exempt for life in the PGA Championship. The I'm going to say this as politely. The PGA Tour make their rules up as they go along, you know. So I wouldn't be surprised if they found some way to welcome him back. But then again, the grandees, the stuffed shirts, they have to pay attention to the sensitivities of the stars that stayed at the PGA Tour. Your Justin Thomas's, your
Jordan Spieth.
Yeah. And not even Rory. I'd say Rory is, again, I can't put words in Rory's mouth, but I don't think Rory would be as hung up on this as maybe Justin Thomas or just Jordan Spieth would. Is that you can't let him back. You can't. He has to serve a suspension. He has to pay a big fine. I would not be surprised if Brooks goes, yeah, fine, yeah, whatever, and yeah, I'll just go play the DP World Tour.
Yeah, and then turn up and play in maybe Shinnecock where he won the US Open before it's on this year and go and win. Wouldn't that be some comeback?
Yeah. But I think legally on it, he resigned his membership of the PGA Tour.
Yeah, so he has to reapply for membership. But the PGA Tour will invariably have to show that it's not as easy as to the lived parties, which they treat as little better than traitors. You know, they talk about them as if they've betrayed the glorious trust of golf. So they can't just let them back in without some kind of process or punishment.
Well, see, the avenue and the storyline back in is if I'm AT&T and I'm sponsoring a tournament or
Bank of Texas
or whoever it is, and we have an opportunity through his management that he's made a desire he'd love to play. I mean, it's manna from heaven, and it's entirely up to the sponsors who, like myself and Shane, could get an invite to Dubai to play next week if the sponsor wants us to play. Now, we've been both down the bottom holding up the field, but it's the sponsors' prerogative.
But the fun you'd have, the two of yous.
Yeah, that'd be good.
But it's the sponsors. Well, I don't know. When you're reloading off the first, you're probably thinking, this is not a good idea. But
do you like his positivity?
Yeah.
Listen, I'm struggling to beat the old fellas, never mind the young fellas. But yeah. I think the sponsors will determine where this is going to go.
Yeah.
And he's a 5-time major champion. He's exempt. I think it's a huge opportunity for DP World. I would be excited as a golf fan if he plays the Dubai Desert Classic. I think it would add to the event. We're all, as the paying public, looking at events and people that add to the event. He didn't play well in Ireland. He didn't play well in Wentworth, but he undoubtedly added to the event. He played fantastic in France. He added to the Dunhill Links.
Yeah.
It would be, I think, an opportunity for DP World Tour to go, listen, there's 8 or 10 starts there. Well, he can play any time he wants as a major champion anyway, but and let him maybe play a little less, but he might have a lot more for the sake of Brooks Koepka's game. He would certainly be, I wouldn't say starting again, but he would have a lot more enthusiasm going to play a few events in Europe to get ready around the majors. The problem, you know, playing in India 2 weeks before Augusta is not going to help. So,
no.
But then you've got the Trump factor too. You know, he's friendly with Donald Trump. He lives in that area.
And the Ryder Cup too. I'm sure Mr. Hurton not being in the Ryder Cup team, you know, and he'd have been a very strong, you know, part of that US
Good
team
point.
If he was there.
I'm looking at his, so we all know that his major record from 2017 to 2023 is incredibly impressive, includes 5 wins, 2 second places, 3 actually, only 2 missed cuts in 6 years. But since 23, since he won at Oak Hill, well, he's missed 3 of the last 4 cuts. And the best finish he had was tied 17th. And that was in, I think, the Masters 24. In 2024, and really no better than 45th or whatever since. Like Liv has not been good for Brooks' major.
I think that's right, true. If you watch John Rahm, is the same. In their own environment in Liv, they're performing quite well. But it's a bit like what I was saying earlier on about the rookies going out on tour. They're used to playing, they've got accustomed to playing 3-round tournaments, finishing on a Saturday.
Not this year.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden, now they're thrown into a major week, and it's just not the same.
Do you think that makes it, like, we've often debated it here, is that, does it make that big a difference, you think, the fourth round?
Yeah, but the whole prep around the week, you know, the whole mental prep of finishing on a Saturday, you're starting later, finishing earlier, a major starts on a Sunday, and the whole prep around it, it's a bigger production. It's just the whole amphitheatre. If you're not used to that, and even the best players who've won majors, if they're taken out of that environment and they're put back into that environment, you can't have the same sharpness or alertness that you would in your height
so
of
by
your
that,
performing.
By that logic, and I've not seen no reason to fault it, LIV going to 72 holes from this year should show improvements in the likes of a John Rahm or a Tyrrell Hatton.
Yes.
Players that you would otherwise expect to perform at majors.
I think so.
I think the big thing for Koepka is he's got to get his mojo back. He's in a little bit of a lull in his career.
Yeah. He's 35, so he still has lots of years left. But,
no, he does. Well, he's probably got six or seven, really.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at what's coming through, and I think he did the live. It made sense to do it financially, but he's lost, you know, even his body language is altered. Now, I know he was telling us he has struggled, you know, massively with his putting. And putting 90% of the time is attitude anyway.
Yeah.
Unless you have a glaring technical deficiency, which he's never had. But he was a bit of a banger of putts, and once you lose a little bit of that... So I think it's a mojo thing for him. If he can get back playing somewhere else, maybe on the PGA Tour, hopefully a bit in Europe, and he gets that strut back, and then he's back in the conversation at the top end of the game.
Would it be in any way surprising, Shane, if rather than the limited field, no-cut events that the PGA Tour is increasingly embracing, that, which he's kind of leaving LIV anyway for, that Brooks's tune-up for the majors will be best served playing in the bigger field events on the DP World Tour, maybe not against the same depth of elite players, but, you know, some very, very good players on some very, very good courses.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a sharpness, and even, you know, whatever level you're going at the top, those majors, they're so sharp, they're ready for it, they're peak performing, they're doing all that modern training. The elite players are talking about peak performing, and Rory talks about it, and being ready, and that sharpness can only be enhanced if you're in that environment, you know, 2 or 3 weeks leading up to it. And some people like playing the week before, some people like take 2 weeks off, 2 weeks on, and then the week off before, and then going into a major. I don't think he could have had the same rituals in LIV that he had for any 1-5 majors, whatever the ritual he had to being successful. Yeah. And a lot of them go back to those. Mm. What was the recipe that I won a major with, and let's try and get back to it. But I have a feeling there'll be more. I think there'll be more Brooks coming back.
I have a feeling
there's going to be a shake-up there. Something's going to come.
I absolutely hope so. I think he's a bona fide superstar. One player who won't feature in the majors this year is Tiger Woods, who turned 50 on the 31st of December. And my social media feeds was the algorithm obviously chucking tons of golf content at me. And lots of different bits of Tiger, lots of nostalgia bits, you know, Tiger's 10 greatest shots, Tiger's 10 greatest shots in the PGA Tour, but also a lot of stuff of Tiger in the last year or so, playing like these like weird pickup games with like American bros. And there was one in particular that actually just left me feeling terribly sad, which was him on a driving range surrounded by all these guys cheering him on. And he hits like a big, massive slicing hook deliberately off the, like, you know, just with an iron, like just big sling hook. And the screaming behind was like, oh, my God, what a shot. And then underneath the caption just going, still the purest ball striker around. I'm like, is this what we're reduced to? The greatest golfer of all time. We're now impressed because he can hit a sling hook on a driving range. That just seems the saddest thing. Gary, tell me I'm wrong.
Well, it is. And that won't be the case because unless he's not going to play unless he's able to physically to play.
Well, he's had more back surgery.
I know. There's more holes in him than Luke Littler's dartboard, I'd say, at this stage. But I think...
Contemporary references. You see that? Very good, Gary. Very good. Yeah.
I'd love to see him, no matter where it is, even if it's the Champions Tour. But that's probably an issue, too. If he does get fit, it's a bit like Harrington. Like, Harrington's down to play those two events in Dubai at the start of the year. So Porik still has aspirations to show it up to the young fellas, I think.
Would it be good to see Porik and Tiger going down the stretch in a British Open, wouldn't it? In Sunningdale.
Yeah, it'd be amazing. I think that might be an avenue for him. And listen, there's a lot of guys that have, you know, kept themselves going. I don't think he's at the level again to win majors, but he,
a senior's major
of his career. Yeah,
a senior's major. That'll be
just to be fit and get out and enjoy his golf again, and we can still.
But don't underestimate if he got a go around Augusta like he did before.
Totally,
he came back the last time around.
Do you think that's possible?
Well, I don't
know. Of course, it's possible.
We don't know how fit he is or what golf. It's kept very much in the background. Known Tiger, he's very private in what he does now. He doesn't let the media see him too much, but he could be playing loads of good golf, and he can take up and pitch up in Augusta, and Tiger in Augusta in any given week. If he got in contention and the crowd got behind him, anything could happen.
It would be incredible.
That's about the only place I could see him winning a major, mind you. But
I think it's no different to Leona, you know, getting back to Florida, playing those money games with her peers to get sharp. He has to be doing that, hanging out with Shane and Rory and Ricky Fowler and Justin Thomas, whoever it is down there, and playing his game and trying to get sharp. He did that at the start of his career with Mark Romero.
You see sometimes, and I appreciate that social media is full of exaggeration and lies, but I see tons of videos where not recovering from ruptured Achilles and back surgery Tiger, but Tiger now hitting 300-yard bombs. Do you believe that like he can't actually turn into his right side? Like, do you believe that he's actually striping it that far? Like, I find that just improbable.
I thought the last time he came back before the last injury was probably some of the best golf swings technically.
Really?
Yeah, I thought technically it was so good. And there's no talk about who he's worked with. I think since he went through three or four coaches over a couple of years, whoever, there is somebody when he turns up at a tournament there, but it's kept very much in the background. But I think with all the metal, as you said, Gary, the holes in his legs, I thought he was swinging the club unbelievably good. He just didn't get any momentum, no run at it. He physically wasn't able to walk the golf course.
Yeah.
You never underestimate him. He's that good.
Maybe I'm protecting my own sense of, because I loved him for so long. And so the narrative that keeps spinning around in my head is that the 21 crash derailed what was a predestined career so spectacularly that all we're left with is nostalgia and like vague hints. But then now hearing you just describe that, I feel like, oh my God, I'm being way too pessimistic.
Just never know. You never know.
I think it's a hope more so than a belief. You know, I just think if it doesn't matter who you are, as great as he is, if you physically can't do it, A, he can't prepare and get ready to go try achieve it, which is the biggest problem. But I think for his own sanity and for all that he's given golf fans, you'd love to see him, you know, maybe out in the Champions Tour where he can ride a cart, which is a big thing.
Yeah.
And just getting the adrenaline of being Tiger again.
I get back to what I said there a few minutes ago, thinking about it there. I'd love to see himself on the Champions Tour, maybe at a couple of events, but see him playing with Porik. So Porik would have played a lot, you know, back the years when Porik was top five in the world and Tiger was hitting 50, 60 past him. And it'd be interesting to see now, Porik has got he's got older, Porik could really enjoy bombing a past Tiger.
I'm looking,
so that'd be interesting to see.
I'm looking at some of the comparisons with past greats. So I'm looking at, say, Nicholas, Snead and Watson, okay? So, and the difference between them and Tiger is that they age with far fewer physical challenges, obviously. So Ben Hogan had his car crash, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm looking. So obviously Jack wins the 86 Masters aged 46. But less remembered is that he put together an amazing Sunday charge in 1998 when he was 58 years old. Like, he ended up sixth behind Mark Romero, but still, like, a 58-year-old Jack Nicklaus kind of threatening the lead a little on the Sunday was kind of interesting. So I was just looking. Sam Snead didn't win a major after turning 50, but was on the leaderboard more than anyone else as an elder, with 9 major top tens, 3 of them after his 60th birthday. Maybe playing in a different era, but still, that's not unimpressive. Obviously, Tom Watson, he did well at the US Open in 2003. He was 53, but obviously it was the 2009 Open at Turnberry at 59. He had it. Why'd you hit the 7-iron? Why? You know, go with the 8. Go. And poor old Stuart Sink, the least popular winner of a major. And then, of course, Phil Mickelson, who won in the oldest major champion at 50. Like, okay, looking at those stats, different players, different situations. Realistically, do we ever imagine Tiger Woods being able to, maybe at Augusta, but like, as Gary says, he has to be fit, he has to be able to walk those big hills, you know, just there's a lot of ifs, ands and buts, aren't there?
Yeah, it's not going to happen. He's not going to get back winning majors on the regular tour. It's just, it's not possible.
No.
Nice to think, though. Nice
it would
think.
Be. Oh, listen, look. All I'm left with is the algorithm spitting old Tiger Woods content at me. Jumbo Ozaki. So Masashi Jumbo Ozaki, who was, until Matsuyama came along, he was the greatest golfer Japan ever produced. Died on Christmas Eve at the age of 78, and the cause was cancer. So just, again, the stats are impressive. So he won the Japan Golf Tour's money list 12 times, won 94 times, a record, and remained inside the official World Golf Rankings top 10 for more than 200 weeks. This is not an unimpressive feat by a Japanese golfer. Finished tied 8th in his 1973 Masters debut, but really only kind of played in Japan except for major appearances thereafter. Like, he was not a big international traveler. So he did admit at the 2011 World Golf Hall of Fame induction that, "My only regret is not playing more outside of Japan, but I dedicated my life to Japanese golf." Do either of you remember Jumbo Ozaki?
Yep.
I do, yeah.
Yeah. I remember watching the Masters, and he'd be there on the leaderboard, and he was long for his time. He was a longer hitter. I remember him playing with Ray Floyd and won Masters, and he was moving out there. A bit unorthodox, but and he had a brother who played in the Masters 1 year as well.
And Joe, yeah.
Yeah, and there was another Jet. Three of them played, and I don't know whether this is a record, but 3 of them played in the 89 Open, and 2 of them made the cut.
Must Google, yeah. That must be a record.
Yeah, so there must be a record for 3 brothers to play in a major, and 2 of them make the cut. Between the 3 of them, I looked it up there, between the 3 of them, they've won over 130 PGA professional events, between the 3 of them.
Wow.
Which is incredible.
I was reading about this, Gary, but in the early 70s, maybe it was at the first major he played in, but he had a 5-degree driver and pushed it well past Jack Nicklaus. And Nicklaus apparently was like, "What the fuck is that? Like, who is this guy?" I mean, and in fairness to Jack could definitely put it out there. But apparently it spawned briefly the J driver craze. So like all these players going for like, you know, crazy degree drivers. Not you, never. It's, you never got tempted, did you?
But it's hilarious, though, when you think of, oh, my hero Jumbo uses a 5-degree. I'm playing off 17. I'm going to buy myself.
Put a 1 in front of it, a 15-degree.
You'd want a Springer Spanger caddy in for you to find it. But
it's so massive.
He was a great player. There's no denying that. And just the wrong era. Like, if you think you had a guy dominating the Japanese tour now, the opportunity he would have to play, he'd be on the PGA Tour in a heartbeat. And we probably would have appreciated his greatness a bit more had he travelled. But the tours, especially the American tour at that time, would have been... You think how much Matsuyama has done for Japanese golf because he had access to... They're no different to great European players who would have been Ryder Cup stars every second year, because they were beating the Americans, but they never had access to the PGA Tour in those days. So.
It was a very close shop, yeah. You couldn't just pitch up and go, yeah.
But a great player, amazing career. Like, what, over 100 wins? It's mental, really.
All right. I mean, like, and again, not to take away from him, he played in 49 majors, but only finished in the top 10 three times. His best finish was tied eighth in his Masters debut, finished tied sixth at the 89 US Open, and then finished tied 10th at the Open in 1979.
But Fiona, it's like Shane was saying earlier, you can't turn up to these, what you were saying about Brooks, like it's hard to turn up to a totally different environment.
Yeah, no, fair enough.
He's the chief of police on the Japanese tour, and all of a sudden he's turning up at a major where it's probably 20 guys are as good as him.
Yeah.
It's a completely different mindset.
Right. Well, I'm going to leave it there. Shane, I have to say thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure and very insightful, I must say. Hope you'll come back to us, will you?
Yeah, anytime. Thanks very much for having me on, Gary and Sean.
Thanks for coming on, Shane. Yeah. Great to have you.
And Gary, as always, cheers. I forgot to ask you, like, the operation all went well. You're feeling, I mean, I know you've had the lurgy, but are you feeling better? And
feeling better, yeah. So we'll see what it brings. Hopefully it takes the bad shots out of my game. Unfortunately, scientifically and medically, it doesn't suggest that it would, but it's the hope that kills it, Fionn.
Yeah, no, sure, I know. Hopes it kills us all. The Rhine Line will be coming to you this Friday. If you have any questions for Shane, you can put them into the Discord channel or you can email golfweekly@offtheball.com. My thanks to Brona on production. This is what I'm going to do this year. Sorry, we're going to thank Brona, who does put this stuff together. So thank you, Brona. And listen, have a good week. And as I said, talk to you on Friday for the Rhine Line. But otherwise, we'll talk to you next week. All my exes wear Rolexes, but I reside right here in Dardanelle, all picket town. Little J.D. Starter.